Her infants were held for 90% of the day, and when the mother wasn't able to hold the child, it was always passed around to other members of the tribe. Travel writer J. Martin Troost noted that the natives of the South Pacific Islands absolutely loved babies. They held them continuously, stated that a baby should never cry, and that you should use your hands to mold the shape of the baby's skull into a nice round shape. When asked to do so for his own newborn, he politely declined. This constant contact has numerous benefits, including a sense of safety and comfort for the baby, increased skin-to-skin contact with the mother, as well as the mother's immediate presence should the baby begin to cry. HG babies rarely cry for more than 10-second bursts, and in total cry far less often than the average baby born in modern society. Being held at the mother's chest allows the child to breastfeed on demand. The baby will suckle multiple times per hour throughout the day. Infant-initiated nursing is practically impossible in our prudish societies, where, much to the chagrin of teenage boys, it is deemed inappropriate for a woman to walk around topless. The baby would have to remove the mother's shirt and bra on its own, a skill generally not mastered until at least high school. HG babies will even nurse when the mother is asleep, as the child will sleep in the same bed as the mother. The common fear today that a child and mom shouldn't sleep in the same bed because she might roll over and smother the child is not a concern shared by HG moms. This could be because HGs sleep on harder surfaces than our cushy beds and are hence less likely to roll over in the night. On average, HG moms breastfeed their children for 3 years. The frequency and duration with which they breastfeed likely activates what is known as lactational amenorrhea, a physiological mechanism that inhibits ovulation and allows the mother to have unprotected sex without fear of getting pregnant for the duration of her breastfeeding. For this reason, HG mothers usually don't have children closer than 4 years apart. I am 2 years older than my brother, and when he was born, I was ecstatic. For a week. Then, I realized that the flood of attention I was used to was now being focused on him instead. I expressed my concern to my mother in rather delicate terms. "Mom, it is time to get rid of Dylan. Throw him out the window. Put him in the garbage. I don't care. Just get rid of him." This sudden bifurcation in parents' emotional investment in their progeny was not something I was genetically programmed for. With good reason. An HG baby received the undivided attention of his parents until age 4, when the next sibling was born. By then, the HG child had a greater sense of autonomy. He also had other children in his tribe to play with. This brings me to the greatest and most psychologically important difference between childhood in HG tribes and in modern life. Education. Have you ever watched two lion cubs playing with each other? They wrestle around, jumping on each other's backs, lightly pawing and biting each other's necks. What looks like innocent goofing around is actually job training for the day when these cubs will grow into full-fledged predators of the savanna and be expected to pounce on wild prey. In the animal world, there is no separation between play and education. Despite the vast expanse of knowledge children in hunter-gatherer tribes had to acquire, none of this learning took place in a classroom setting. All the skills they needed to master were directly connected to their future profession as savants of the natural world. Children acquired this mastery not from intense study, but by the same method other mammals in the animal kingdom learn. Imitation and play. And play they did, from the time they woke up until the time they went to sleep. Parents in contemporary HG societies do not express any worry about their child's education. They don't plan any curricula, nor do they teach a child anything unless directly asked. The kids learn completely on their own and through their own initiative. Children are considered autonomous individuals who are free to do whatever they want nearly all day long. The children run off into the forest with their little spears and bows and arrows, where they hunt small game and pretend to wage mock wars. They build play huts, smaller versions of the real huts they live in, and put on theatrical performances, acting out how they have observed adults interacting. They learn to build tools such as arrowheads, rope, and rafts, mostly with the help of other children, who teach them all this in the process of playing a game. Not until late adolescence are these children considered old enough to do work, and when it is time for them to contribute to the group, they do so willingly. Children in primitive societies are raised with a hands-off approach to a degree that modern parents would consider madness. It is common in an HG village to see a 2-year-old swinging around a machete. This is so unusual, I have a hard time believing it, but it is completely unnatural for a parent to tell their child what to do, even when saying something could keep the child from great harm. Despite our fears that without our guidance, children will grow up to be maniacs, this simply doesn't happen in HG society. As anthropologist Elizabeth Marshall Thomas wrote of the Juhonsi tribe, "Juhoan children very rarely cried, probably because they had little to cry about. No child was ever yelled at or slapped or physically punished, and few were even scolded. Most never heard a discouraging word until they were approaching adolescence, and even then the reprimand, if it really was a reprimand, was delivered in a soft voice. We are sometimes told that children who are treated so kindly become spoiled, but this is because those who hold that opinion have no idea how successful such measures can be. Free from frustration or anxiety, sunny and cooperative, the children were every parent's dream. No culture can ever have raised better, more intelligent, more likable, more confident children." Jared Diamond, reflecting on the 49 years that he had known tribes in the New Guinea Highlands and reviewing what other Westerners had written about HG children, had this to say. "A recurring theme is that other Westerners and I are struck by the emotional security, self-confidence, curiosity, and autonomy of members of small-scale societies, not only as adults, but already as children. We see that people in small-scale societies spend far more time talking to each other than we do. We are struck by the precocious development of the social skills in their children. The adolescent identity crisis that plagues American teenagers isn't an issue for hunter-gatherer children." I would add to Diamond's assessment that it is not just a case of the things they do that we don't, but the numerous stresses HGs don't have to endure that our kids do. As I remember my childhood, I think back to the absolute dread that accompanied a Monday morning, waking up to an alarm clock far earlier than I wished and having to drag myself to the bus stop. The hours spent daydreaming as I struggled to tune into the endless drone of a lecturer, gazing out the window and checking the clock, counting down the hours to when the final school bell rang and I was free to go home and play with the neighborhood kids. There is a reason boys roughhouse, run around and otherwise can't sit still in classrooms, or that girls are constantly chatting and discreetly texting each other while they're supposed to be studying. A reason that children of all ages struggle to do homework, dislike doing chores, and are otherwise disobedient to their parents' demands. Kids are not genetically programmed to sit in classrooms, learn material that they see as unrelated to things they want to do, or to have their freedom to do what they want, when they want, infringed upon in any way. So what can we do? Clearly, we are not going to take our children out of school and stop teaching them reading, writing, and arithmetic. And if we let them do what they want, when they want, they might not even put down that iPad. The world children grow up in today is so vastly different from the one of our ancestors, it might seem that all is hopeless. But there are a few things we can do to help our kids grow up with more confidence and autonomy. Number one is stop being so overprotective. In my work as a brain trainer, I have a lot of clients who are children, and I get to see how their mothers interact with them and, inevitably, what kind of personalities the kids have. One child, a fifth grader, had to leave the office to go to the hallway bathroom, a mere 10 feet away. His mother, immediately worrying about him, followed him to the bathroom and waited outside until he came back out. She meant well, but her overbearing coddling was the exact opposite of what her son needed to become a self-confident, autonomous individual. In training, he was a little crybaby. Tears would flow the moment he had to do anything remotely challenging. Kids learn confidence by overcoming obstacles, especially ones that they perceive as dangerous. Let them roughhouse and go exploring deep in the woods. Don't force them to check in every 5 minutes to make sure they are okay. Let them run off and come back when they feel like it. In other words, stop worrying about them. Psychologists understand that worrying is a learned behavior, and that anxious parents teach their children to worry. They view the world as a dangerous place, and this paradigm is then passed on to the child. A child is up to 7 times more likely to develop an anxiety disorder if a parent has an anxiety problem himself. While you might think that your worrying is proactively keeping them safe, the reality is this. Teaching the child to worry and feel that the world is a scary place is only going to lead to raising a neurotic kid. Neuroticism is the death knell of well-being, having effects both on the child's happiness and on the child's physical health, as we know that stress can break down the proper functioning of a child's immune system. Of course, you can still teach a child not to get into cars with strangers and to look both ways when crossing the street, but you can do this with a calm rationality. Embrace the paradox that to raise a happy and healthy child, you can't worry about your child's health and happiness. Beautiful faces. What makes for an attractive face? For men, it is symmetrical features, a chiseled jawline, prominent cheekbones. A pretty woman has a face that is broad, symmetrical with high cheekbones, a small nose, and wide-set eyes. Look at yourself in the mirror just as you have done thousands of times before and examine the dimensions of your face. How closely do they align with the standard of beauty? Has your attractiveness improved or waned over time? How did you end up with the face that you have now? Was it destined since the moment of your birth, or has your behavior and environment shaped the way your face has grown? We all know that diet, posture, and exercise can radically change the attractiveness of our bodies, but few realize that diet, posture, and exercise also affect the attractiveness of the most visible appendage we have, the one positioned directly above the neck. According to Dr. Mike Mew, only a small percentage of people in modern society have properly formed faces, the Clint Eastwoods and Kate Mosses of the world. The other 95% of us poor schmucks have faces that range from slightly off-kilter to grossly hideous. This is the exact opposite of ancestral society, where nearly everyone was good-looking. Or, at the very least, they thought so. In a study done on the Maasai by psychologist Robert Biswas-Diener, every single one of the 120 people he asked said that they were completely satisfied with their physical appearance. Is there anyone you know in modern society who could make that claim? When I visited the Waurani tribe of the Amazon, one of the first things that struck me about their appearance was their teeth. Were they brown, missing, and crooked, as you would expect a person who had never visited a dentist? No, they were perfect, not only in their color, but in their alignment. The best Beverly Hills orthodontist could not have done better. The Mew family agrees. Mew is a third-generation orthodontist, and it was his father who traveled to the jungle of Kenya to find tribal people and study their teeth. What did he find? Not only did the majority have straight teeth, despite having never seen an orthodontist, but they also had their wisdom teeth intact. And, surprisingly, they even had 10 millimeters of extra room behind their wisdom teeth. When I got my wisdom teeth taken out as a late teenager, I was perplexed by the explanation that my mouth wasn't naturally big enough to fit all my teeth. Why, then, did I have these extraneous teeth in the first place? Were they really a useless relic of our Cro-Magnon past? No, as a group of dentists and orthodontists have been finding out. The problem is that our faces have become unnaturally long and thin, leaving our jaws too narrow for our teeth to grow into place properly. This results in malocclusion, the scientific term for crooked teeth. In the 1960s, a group of anthropologists studied the hunter-gatherer tribe in Brazil, known as the Xavante. 95% of the Xavante had perfect smiles. Their teeth were aligned, their arches wide, while the other 5% had only slightly imperfect smiles with just some mild crowding of the front teeth. Not a single Xavante had an overbite or underbite. A neighboring tribe living at a government outpost and eating more processed foods showed a far greater prevalence of malocclusion. In his extensive studies of the dental health of tribal societies around the world, Dr. Weston Price noticed the same thing. Every time a group shifted from their traditional diet to a modern one, their rates of malocclusion skyrocketed. And it's not just present-day traditional societies that show stunning dental health. Our ancestors did even better. Dr. Price studied hundreds of prehistoric skulls found in burial grounds of ancient South American, Australian, and New Zealand peoples. None of the skulls showed evidence of tooth decay, malocclusion, or dental arch deformity. But the descendants of these people who adopted modern culture all show high instances of these failings. Why does this happen? What is going on in modern society that is causing our faces to become deformed and hence give us bad teeth? It's always good to start at the beginning, and we might think that this means in the womb, where our skulls begin to develop a bit after the first month of pregnancy. Of course, the nutrients we get from our mother's diet are essential for ensuring that we have proper facial growth during this time period. But our time in the womb can also be affected by what our moms ate in the months prior to our being conceived. According to neurobiologist Stephen Guyonette, vitamins A, folic acid, D, and vitamin K2 are stored in the body for a long period of time. He notes that many tribal societies would prepare mothers for pregnancy by ensuring that they stocked up on green leafy vegetables and meat. The shaping of the face and jaw mostly takes place between birth and age 4. Hence, the majority of facial deformities and malocclusion will be established during this period. A key aspect of attractiveness, facial symmetry, can be derailed due to childhood malnutrition, illness, exposure to tobacco smoke, and pollutants. Studies have shown that the longer a woman breastfeeds her child, the more nourished he or she will be, and the less likely the child will develop malocclusion. On top of that, bottle feeding, pacifier use, and thumb sucking all dramatically increase the rate of malocclusion. The muscles a baby uses while breastfeeding, as well as chewing solid food when it is able to, will lead to the foundation of strong, healthy jaws. We all know that exercise is important for the health and growth of our muscles and bones. So why would we think that it would be any different for the muscles and bones in our face? The single best predictor of malocclusion is whether the person ate soft or tough foods. Those that ate soft foods early in life have jaws that developed improperly. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors ate a variety of tough, unprocessed foods that gave their jaws a real workout. Biting into a steak and chewing on the fat is harder than eating pasta. And they didn't just use their teeth for eating, but also for holding items while their hands were occupied, or working with leather and fibers. And while your orthodontist can fix your teeth, your orthodontist doesn't do anything about the underlying problem. Your deformed mug. When we don't have nice strong jaws, a cascade of other problems ensue. Without a sufficiently large jaw, our tongues have less room in our throat, and this interferes with breathing. We compensate for this by opening our mouths to let in more air. When we breathe through our mouths, the tongue isn't resting in its proper position on the roof of the mouth. Without the pressure from the tongue on the roof of the mouth, the top of your mouth will cave in, dropping downwards and thinning, leaving less horizontal room for all your teeth. Hello, malocclusion. Also, with less airway space, hello snoring, hello sleep apnea, hello angry spouse. What can we do to stop all this? Listen to your grandmother. Develop good posture, stand up straight, and make sure that your neck isn't leaning too far forward, that your ears align with your shoulders. This opens up your chest and throat for proper breathing through the nostrils as you keep your mouth shut and your teeth touching, or nearly so. Dr. Mew recommends the mantra, teeth together, lips together, tongue at the roof of your mouth. And eat your carrots. Why can't I see? Sometime during my teenage years, I began waving to people I didn't know. Have we met? Asked the perplexed stranger. Oh, sorry, I thought you were my friend. At the time, I blamed my poor vision on genetics. After all, my father had similar vision. My brother wore contacts, so it all just made sense. I pondered how it was that the gene for bad eyesight had not been weeded out of existence thousands of years ago. Corrective lenses haven't been around that long, so how did our ancestors survive when they couldn't even see what was right in front of them? By the time they reached adolescence, they would have run into a tree or mistaken a venomous snake for a twig and been hastily swept out of the gene pool. The theory that myopia, nearsightedness, was due to bad genetics was the prominent view among scientists in the middle of the 20th century, despite evidence of the fantastic vision of hunter-gatherers. The 1937 study, The Ocular Refractive State of the Palais Negroids in Gabon, French Equatorial Africa, that title wouldn't fly today, showed that of the 2,364 members of the various hunter-gatherer tribes in the region studied, only 13 total eyes had any incidence of myopia. Far away on the other side of the Atlantic, tribes of Amazonian Indians reported only 2% of their population to be nearsighted. Similarly, a 1954 study done on the Eskimos of Greenland found evidence of myopia in only 1.2% of the population. Still, the scientists who thought vision was mostly genetic stuck to their guns. It was felt that there would have been tremendous evolutionary pressure on HG groups to develop great eyesight, something lost to the modern world. But then evidence started mounting, evidence that just could not be explained away by anything other than environmental factors. Another group of Eskimos from Alaska was studied. The older members of the group who had lived an HG existence had a rate of myopia of only 1.5%. Their children acclimated to a modern existence, and the first members of the tribe to grow up attending school weren't so lucky. Unlike their elders, they spent their days inside reading books. The rate of myopia for the new generation? 51%. The genetic hypothesis further crumbled as a wave of myopia swept the modern world. Nowhere has the effect been more pronounced than in East Asia, where rates of myopia amongst 20-year-olds have risen from the 10 to 20% range to upwards of 90% in the last 50 years. Clearly, this problem has an environmental component. But what is the cause? Scientists began to look for correlations that could explain this epidemic of myopia. What were kids doing differently now than they were a century ago? There seemed to be an obvious answer. Children were spending a lot more time in front of computer screens, playing video games, and doing obscene amounts of studying and homework, especially those brainy Asian kids. Could all this looking at objects up close be the cause of nearsightedness? Research experiments were done that tracked kids, their habits, and their rate of myopia. What they found was surprising. The kids whose eyesight remained intact did not vary much in terms of the amount of time that they read or used a computer. Sure, it mattered some, but it wasn't telling the whole story. There was another variable, however, that did prove to be the major player. the kids who were consistently least affected by nearsightedness across studies, across continents, were the ones who spent more time playing outdoors. Being outside has at least two protective functions against losing your eyesight: greater viewing distances and exposure to bright light. Spending more time gazing off into the distance seems to have an obvious benefit if your goal is to further the distance you can see. But how does being exposed to bright light help? The physical cause of myopia is a lengthening of the eyeball, which was a bit of a mystery for researchers. How does decreasing your exposure to bright light cause your eyeball to lengthen? The leading hypothesis is that humans naturally have a diurnal rhythm, sending a spike of dopamine to the retina when exposed to daylight. If our eyes don't get this injection of dopamine, your eye development gets out of whack and the eyeball will lengthen. Light entering the eye gets refracted and the image won't reach all the way to the retina, which is located at the back of the eyeball. Hence, nearsightedness. The allure of the indoor universe with the advent of computers, video games, and television is strong. But even a well-lit room provides light levels of only about 500 lux. The amount needed for myopia prevention is at least 10,000 lux for 3 hours a day. This is the kind of bright light that our ancestors bathed in on sunny afternoons. No soap, no shampoo. Ah, the wonderful Halloween, a night where women are free to dress in scanty, seductive outfits without the fear of being labeled sluts. Me? I was braving the cold in a pair of tighty-whities as part of my Tom Cruise and Risky Business outfit. I knew it would garner attention, but as I would later find out, it wasn't my top weapon of attraction for the night. A dozen of my friends and I went out clubbing in the city, dancing and inhaling assorted libations, when my buddy Steve met a provocative woman dressed in a titillating schoolgirl's costume. Her friend, dressed as a ballerina, was cute too, and I chatted her up. Vodka-infused drinks were bought, and sensual dancing ensued. The girls took a liking to us and followed us from one club to the next. We were in. Steve was going to hook up with a schoolgirl and me with a ballerina. But then something interesting happened. As we posed for a group picture, the schoolgirl got close to me. A flip was switched, and for the rest of the night, she stuck to me like glue, dancing with me, sitting on my lap, holding my hand. She jumped ship from Steve to me. At first, I put off her advances, but when I realized Steve didn't care which of these two girls he hooked up with, I turned to the ballerina and said, "Go be with Steve. He likes you." Realizing that I preferred her friend, she acquiesced. The two of them got along swimmingly, and the schoolgirl was all mine. Later that night, basking in a post-coital glow, I turned to the schoolgirl and asked her why the change of heart. She seemed to be really into Steve, so why did she suddenly jump all over me? "When I got really close to you for that group picture, I smelled you," she said. "And you smelled hot, like a man. And Steve, he just smelled like nothing. You smelled so good I was overcome with the most intense compulsion to fellate you." I laughed and told her my dirty little secret. I hadn't used soap or shampoo in the shower in months. My no-soap, no-shampoo lifestyle began with a thought experiment. There are billions of species of social animals on this planet. They live together in bands, roll around in the dirt, swim in rivers, run, exercise, sweat and make love with each other, all without ever using bars of oily fats derived from animal innards mixed with hard-to-pronounce metals in order to cleanse themselves. Yet our species is somehow different. Ask a random person on the street what would happen if the entire population neglected to wash with soap, and you would probably get an answer along the lines of, "The smell would be unbearable. It would be like France, but way worse." Yet for hundreds of thousands of years, Homo sapiens lived with each other, slept in the same huts, embraced, hugged, cuddled, and ate meals together long before the invention of soap. Soap only was invented a few thousand years ago, and only became widely used in the past few centuries. Are we to believe that for all that time, people were walking around each other with their noses clenched? Skeptic. But wait just a minute. If I go a couple of days without showering, I smell. I mean, I really smell. This isn't just in my imagination. Answer. Oh, I'm sure you do. The problem is that the constant soaping and lathering have stripped your body of its natural cleansing mechanisms and healthy bacteria. Your body produces an oil called sebum, which has the beneficial effects of killing germs, protecting against the sun, and moisturizing the skin. It also has vital anti-inflammatory properties, and is a delivery system for antioxidants and pheromones, the chemicals that attract you to the opposite sex. Every time you wash with soap, you not only wash off any grime you have accumulated, you also wash off your natural, healthy oils. You spend countless dollars trying to replace their functions with moisturizers, sunscreen, perfumes, and other products, when all you had to do was not wash it away in the first place. Your hair and skin also serve as a home to a living microbiome of miniature organisms. These bacteria and fungi play a beneficial role to your overall health because of their symbiotic relationship. The positive effects of good bacteria include producing their own antibiotics that kill off bad bacteria, fight off skin infections, and produce their own fragrance. It could take your body weeks to fully recover the microbiome and restore your skin to its natural sebum production after using soap. The reason you smell after not bathing for a few days is because during your last washing, you stripped away your body's natural oils and bacteria, and now have nothing to replace it with. After some time, when your body returns to normal functioning, your smell will no longer be putrid, but will be rather pleasant. Even the nether regions, which I have been complimented on as giving off the aroma of a berry lollipop. And this isn't just for men who want to be manly. It works for the fairer sex as well. Love at first smell. That is how I would describe one particular romance I had with a flower child from San Francisco. What was her secret? Was it a special perfume? I doubt it, for chemical fragrances are often too pungent for my tastes. A special blend of pheromones that matched perfectly to the aesthetic preference of my nostrils? Perhaps. But I believe the answer was given as we walked hand in hand through a tree-lined path in the orange hue of autumn, her hair blowing in the breeze, me floating in the air like Pepe Le Pew. Why did she smell so good? I don't use soap in the shower, she said. During my puerile, naive years, those first 28 years of my life when I wasted precious minutes of my morning plastering globs of sodium lauryl sulfate and other chemicals on my head, I had dry, unmanageable hair that became a greasy mess if I went so long as 24 hours without using shampoo. I imagined at the time that if I were to suspend shampoo use indefinitely, my hair would grow exponentially greasier and malodorous. How silly I was. When I decided to purge shampoo from my life, I did my research and planned for the future. I knew that in response to the chemicals that strip away the natural oils on your head, the scalp will produce excess sebum. Hence, the greasy look a mere 24 hours after using shampoo. After decades of daily washing, my scalp was accustomed to producing enormous amounts of sebum every day, and this would not change overnight. I was going to have to go through an adjustment period where my hair, which was pretty long at the time, would look as if I had bathed it in mayonnaise. And to be honest, for the next 2 months, my hair was pretty gross. But then my scalp turned a corner and shut off the too much sebum faucet, and my hair became less and less greasy, finally resting in a place where my hair has a natural shine. It is easily manageable, and I don't need any styling products. I do have days where my hair does get greasy without a good rinse, but not nearly as bad as it would be if I had been using shampoo and then went some time without. Once you make it past the initial recovery phase of the no-soap, no-shampoo lifestyle, you will be shocked that almost no one notices. Here you are, engaging in hygiene practices that most people would consider repugnant, and yet they remained completely unawares. Give the no-soap, no-shampoo lifestyle a chance. As to whether you should divulge your secret to the average close-minded commoner, I'll leave that decision up to you. Are toilets bad for you? I awoke to the sounds of birds and crickets as the morning sunbeams crept through the canvas fibers of my sleeping tent. I unzipped the semicircular opening and stepped out to embrace the rarefied air. I yawned and stretched out to my full height, taking in the endless sea of conifers and mountain ridges spread out in every direction from our 8,500-foot perch overlooking Lake Tahoe. The radiance of the moment was only interrupted by the rumbling in my belly caused by last night's canned dinner. But I did not despair, for these grumblings portended a new opportunity. A chance to conquer a necessary rite of passage into adulthood, to help put an end to an adolescence that had overstayed its welcome, dogging me well into my mid-twenties. To engage in a ritual that connected a primal part of my being to all other forms of life on the planet. It was time to take a shit in the woods. Once upon a time, this was the only way to relieve yourself, before the invention of the outhouse, and eventually the home toilet. We now hide ourselves alone in a room, sit down, and empty our bowels in total seclusion. We flush away the remnants, never to be seen again. This is the dignified way to do it, right? Not like a pathetic animal, depositing our turds on the cold, hard ground. Alas, friends, never underestimate the mental insularity that comes with the pretense of being civilized. As I walked away from the tent in search of a pristine spot to dispose of my droppings, I began to grow a bit trepidatious. My callowness in the art of defecating au naturel began to froth up in the form of apprehensive thoughts. What about technique? I simply squat all the way down, right? Will my legs get tired? What if someone sees me? True, I had walked deep into the woods to make sure no one would come near, but there was still a possibility that someone could walk past. How awkward would that be? Here I am squatting down, taking a dump, and someone could just walk right past me out here in the open wilderness. Fuck it. I'm going for it. I squatted all the way down. My fear that this might be a long bowel movement quickly passed. With the angle of my body in the full squat position, it came out quick, fast, clean. Never in my life had I experienced such a sublime, effortless expulsion of feces. I looked around the mountaintop where I was squatting. The beautiful sunshine lit my face. The songs of the birds danced on the waves of crisp air. I felt free. Then it hit me. A thought so profound, I had to tell someone at once. I rushed back to the campsite where my friends were. They were packing for the day's hike. I interrupted them. "It's all a scam," I yelled. "What? What are you talking about? What's a scam?" "Toilets." That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Toilets are bad for you. Here in the Western world, we think of the elevated toilet where we sit with our legs at a 90-degree angle as the only way to take a dump. It may shock you to know that most of the world uses the squat toilet instead. A squat toilet is basically a hole in the ground that will also flush in the same manner as our toilets. It is not only more natural, but a quicker and healthier way to take a shit. The evidence is backed by science. Honest. In a paper published in the Journal of Medical Hypotheses, hilariously entitled, "Cardiovascular Events at Defecation, Are They Unavoidable?", the angle of the sitting position is said to be obstructive, causing the defecating human to try and force out the excrement with multiple excessive pushes that tax the cardiovascular system. While it may seem ridiculous, dying of a heart attack on the toilet is a common cause of death amongst the elderly. Dr. Berko Sikorov, the leading researcher in this field, his mother is very proud, says that the sitting position is 3 times more strenuous than the squatting position and can lead to hemorrhoids and colonic diverticulosis. For those of us in relatively good health, there are other benefits of the squatting position. Primarily, it is faster and smoother. Dr. Sikoroff did another study where he timed how long people defecated in both the squatting and sitting positions. By his calculations, the average time squatters spent shitting was 51 seconds, the fastest being a 21-year-old female who over a 6-shit sample averaged only 5 seconds per dump. Incredible. For those sitting at the average toilet height, it was 2 minutes and 10 seconds. Anecdotally, I can confirm these results and add that the most time added on is in the act of cleaning up. When squatting, the feces comes out so smoothly that you hardly have to wipe. If you have grown up in the Western world and don't feel like remodeling your entire bathroom to put in a squat toilet, it's okay. There are other options. There are awkward contraptions that you can place around your toilet that you can stand on and squat. But the most practical option is to get a stool that you can put your feet on. A popular brand is called Squatty Potty. While you won't be able to get into the full squat position, it is still better than your normal sitting posture. From personal experience, let me assure you that this simple device will make the process of emptying your bowels more enjoyable. It is far healthier, and it will save you lots of time. Then, go ahead and get a cheap bidet that attaches to your toilet so that you never have to wipe again. You can thank me afterwards for changing your life. Work, a modern invention. In the Amazon jungle, I awoke to the sounds of birds singing and the river flowing. Not in any great hurry, I stretched out in the sun and chatted leisurely with my native guides Fausto and Orlando. They were members of the Quechua tribe, a native Amazonian group who fought a vicious war with the Guarani only a generation ago. But things had settled down in the past few years, and I had hired them to take me to visit the Guarani. They asked me what I wanted to do most during the time I would spend living with the Guarani, and I could only think of one answer. I wanted to hunt. Fabiano showed up around 9 a.m. wearing his traditional Guarani getup, a simple skirt made out of bark, plus a new pair of green rain boots. After 25 years of going barefoot, his third poisonous snake bite only a week earlier had finally convinced him of the benefits of donning protective footwear. Over his right shoulder, he had an 8-foot blowgun. Slung over his left shoulder was a quiver of darts, coated at the tips with poison. He handed me a spear. At first, I thought it was just for me to examine, so I looked it over and handed it back to him. "No," he said, "it was for me to use during the hunt. How else was I supposed to kill a charging boar?" Fausto and Orlando would get spears as well, and the four of us trekked off into the jungle. Fabiano's knowledge of the flora and fauna was mind-boggling. We stopped at something he calls the toucan plant, because by ripping off one of its leaves, licking it, and rolling it up, you can bring it to your lips and make a whistling sound that imitates the mating call of a toucan. We continued our walk through the thicket of giant leaves, spider webs, and thorny underbrush. We were moving slowly, quietly, not wanting to alert any potential game to our presence. Suddenly, Fabiano waved for us to stop dead in our tracks. Peccaries. That is, Amazonian boar. We could hear them off in the distance, but they were down a deep incline from us, so we would have to approach carefully. He began to load his blowgun. I looked over at Orlando, seemingly uninterested in the peccaries, his eyes fixed on the canopy above us. "Monkeys," he whispered. Fabiano turned with his blowgun and aimed towards the sky. Too late, they spotted us, and those quick little guys took off, hopping from branch to branch, and were soon out of sight. For some reason, Fabiano gave up on trying to catch the peccaries as well, and instead turned his attention towards hunting toucans. There were plenty of them around. The only problem was that they were sitting on branches at least 150 feet above the ground. Not an easy shot, even for a blowgun specialist like Fabiano. He shot at 5 different birds, but each time the dart whizzed inches away from its target, never quite hitting the mark. Unable to shoot or spear any wild animals, we turned our attention to gathering fruits. Orlando noticed a bunch of purple fruits that had fallen from a tree onto the ground. Orlando then scaled the tree, which had no branches and was only about 6 inches in diameter, until he was at least 50 feet up. He then shook the branches containing the fruit, and soon hundreds of the purple nuts fell to the ground. We ate a few on the spot. But the real treasure would be later on when we mashed them up and turned these fruits into a chocolate-flavored drink. Lacking a receptacle to carry them in, Fabiano grabbed a nearby plant and in under a minute folded the leaves together to construct a makeshift basket. With fruits in hand, we still needed to acquire some protein. Fabiano saw what looked to me like any ordinary branch of a plant. He sliced it open to reveal a colony of lemon ants. "Eat," he said. "Tastes good, like lemon. Once my father and I were lost in the jungle for days, and all we had to go on were eating these ants." I scooped up a handful and chucked them in my mouth. They really did taste like lemon. But these tasty ants weren't going to be enough to feed us or his family, so we went to the river to catch some fish. The Waurani don't use a rod and reel to fish. Fabiano offered 2 reasons for this. The first was sensible. The fish in this river don't have teeth capable of latching onto the bait. The second, to my scientific ears, sounded completely absurd. To catch one of these fish with a rod and reel was a bad omen. If you did so, your family would die. Sensing my incredulity, Fabiano told a story of a girl who once caught a fish in this river with a rod and reel. A month later, her father died. With conventional fishing gear declared off-limits, Fabiano used a net to quarter off part of the river. If a fish swam into the net, he grabbed it with his bare hands and tossed it onto the shore where it would suffocate. Smaller fish were simply caught by placing our hands under rocks where they might be hiding. To kill them, we bit them in the head before they could squirm free from our fingers. By mid-afternoon, we returned to the village with a basket brimming with fish and fruits. I asked Fabiano how often he goes hunting or fishing. He said only once every couple of weeks. Other times, he eats the yucca and plantains that the women gather. Or another male in the tribe will catch a monkey to share with everyone. If hunting is considered work, Fabiano hardly worked at all. While the public perception is that our foraging ancestors slaved and toiled year-round in search of sustenance, the truth is they were the most leisurely people on the face of the earth. They didn't have jobs. There were no lawyers, accountants, or factory workers back then. All that was needed to live the good life was to go out into the wilderness and get food. And that didn't take long. Studies of the Kun tribe in Botswana reveal that they spent between 12 and 19 hours a week collecting the food they needed. The Hadza of Tanzania did it in about 14 hours. Other tribes in Africa and the Amazon spent similar amounts of time in search of food. Sure, they had to do other things, making baskets, collecting firewood, preparing food, etc., but modern people have to do our numerous chores every day on top of the 40 hours a week we spend trapped in our offices. The human animal is simply not equipped, either physically or mentally, to work more than a few hours a day. The Protestant work ethic is not going to lead to happiness. It is going to kill you. In construction and transportation jobs, accidental death occurs frequently. For an office job, a period of long stressful hours is known to cause heart failure. In Japan, they have a term called karoshi, which means death from overwork. In the United States, we don't classify people whose hearts stop during overtime work as having died from work-related stress, but it does happen to us too. And if we aren't dying from working 30 hours in a row with no breaks, our careers are killing us slowly. Long working hours correlate with prolonged sitting, increased psychological stress, lack of leisure time, lack of family contact, and inadequate time to exercise and eat healthy meals. All of this leads to poor health and premature death, not to mention anxiety and depression. Despite this grim outlook, there is a substantial portion of the population who would love to have these first-world problems. They suffer from the far more hazardous condition of not being employed at all. According to a study done at Harvard, laid-off workers were 83% more likely to develop a stress-related illness than the employed. In Finland, a study showed that people who had been unemployed at least twice in their lives were nearly three times more likely to die an early death. Even the fear of losing one's job has been shown to raise one's cholesterol levels. This dire fear of unemployment was not something our ancestors had to face. It's not just the workload or lack of work that cause all our contemporary health problems. Another trouble in the 21st century is that most of us feel a lack of meaning and purpose at our jobs. Studies have shown that people who have a direction and purpose live longer. The problem with finding meaning and purpose in life in modern society is twofold. One, we have so many choices about what to do for work that we are too paralyzed to make choices. Two, the activities that we engage in are hardly recognized by our body as contributing to our survival and replicating value, SRV. Our HG ancestors did not suffer from career-related stress. They didn't have to decide whether they wanted to be insurance salesmen, writers, accountants, or strippers. They didn't have to decide whether to take the high-paying job at the law firm or work for the nonprofit at a vastly reduced salary. While we often think having a number of options to choose from is a good thing, psychologists have now shown that when faced with too many choices, people get stressed out. Ganga, a living member of the Hadzabe tribe in Africa, had this to say about who he was. "Only when I am sleeping, I am not a hunter. I am a hunter all the time I am awake. That is what I am and who I am. I kill animals for meat." Hunting, or gathering for women, is the original career choice for humans. There is a direct connection between the necessity to hunt and the end goal of eating food. With any other job in modern society, the degrees of separation from the ultimate objective take away from its meaning. This is problem number two. The reward system to motivate us towards actions that are beneficial for our survival and replication value evolved during our days in the African savanna. Work in the modern world is too far removed from what your body knows to be beneficial for your SRV. Imagine you are a bank teller. You help people withdraw and deposit money from their accounts. You sit behind a counter, press buttons on a computer. You don't particularly enjoy this job. You do it so you can get paid, so that you have money to buy food. Being a bank teller raises your SRV, but in such a way that your body hardly recognizes it. Working to earn money to go to the store to buy food is not as visceral an objective as hunting. I am hungry. I must find an animal, engage in a life-or-death battle with it, kill it, and then eat it. I'll bring it home to the tribe, where the women will be grateful for the danger I have put myself in to bring them this delicious source of protein, and they will sleep with me for it. We are all searching for a job, a purpose that replicates hunting and gathering. We just aren't aware of it. People often say things like, "I want to do something meaningful." Jobs that are often described as meaningful are those that help other people, like being a nurse, a teacher, an environmental scientist, or running a nonprofit organization. Think about it, though. What could be more meaningful than feeding your entire hungry tribe, your family and friends who you have known your entire life? To put food in your hungry belly and theirs. There cannot be any job more meaningful than hunting or gathering. Imagine a conversation about finding purpose and meaning in life conducted between you and Ganga. You: I want to do something exciting. Ganga: What could be more exciting than fighting a wild animal in the game of life or death? You: I want to do something that is intellectually challenging. Ganga: Have you ever learned how to track game? Can you tell where that antelope will be by the footprint he left in the dirt? You: I can't handle the monotony of my job. Ganga: Today, we hike into the forest for wild boar. In a few days, we will fish by the river. And then we will set traps to catch birds. You: I don't like my coworkers or my boss. Ganga: I hunt with my friends and cousins. My wife gathers food with her sisters and friends. They will laugh and gossip. You: I spend most of my day sitting in front of a computer screen, ruining my eyes and getting fat. Ganga: I hike every day in beautiful nature. I stare into the distant horizon. I bathe in the sun's rays. I am lean and muscular. You: Work is stressful. I want to do something different, but I can't risk losing my paycheck. Ganga: I love to hunt. I don't even have a word in my vocabulary that corresponds to work. Sex, love, and relationships. When men from the Aka Pygmy tribe in Africa told anthropologists Barry and Bonnie Hewlett how often they had sex, the scientists laughed it off. It was just men boasting. No way these guys were having sex 3 to 4 times a night. But then the anthropologist went and asked the women, and it turned out that the men weren't exaggerating at all. The Aka women are so ravenous that their male partners live with the fear that they must inseminate these women multiple times before the sun rises, lest the women leave them. To protect against this, the men gathered a natural Viagra from the bark of a local tree called Bulumba, which acts as a sexual stimulant. The Aka experience is a far cry from the modern stereotype humorously examined in Annie Hall. Speaking to a therapist, Woody Allen's character is asked how often he has sex. Hardly ever, maybe 3 times a week. His girlfriend, played by Diane Keaton, is shown on the split screen answering the same question from her therapist. Constantly, I'd say 3 times a week. If that couple had stayed together, chances are the frequency of their copulations would have dropped even further. Recent research suggests the average married couple has sex about 1 a week. 1 out of every 5 married couples has sex less than 10 times a year, and somewhere between 25% of men and 40% of women complain of having no sex drive at all. How did it get this way? A modern love story. Jack and Jill meet. She thinks he's cute. He can't wait to sleep with her. They go on a date to assess common interests. They like the same obscure indie band. They both love Barcelona. She loves rollerblading. He pretends he does too. More drinks are ordered. Hair is fiddled with, hands are touched, an Uber is called, and they are back at his place to watch a movie. A few minutes of spastic humping ensue, and he orgasms. She pretends that she does too. Remarkably, she would like to see him again. They go for a hike, tell stories about their childhood, make love. There are double dates with friends, dance lessons, and awkward encounters with each other's parents. They can't believe how lucky they are to have found each other. That one true person of all the billions on earth that brings the soul to completion. There are roses and poems and fights over why is your ex texting you and makeup sex in the Caribbean. A tiny sliver of compressed coal forged by the blood of mutilated African children is bought at the price of a car, and is displayed on the woman's left hand so she can brag about it to her friends. Look at how much I'm loved. They nod and feign shouts of excitement, masking their insecurity over this reminder of their own romantic failings. A year is spent in perpetual stress over momentous decisions about the type of font to be used on the wedding invitation and the color of the bridesmaids' dresses. When all is said,